No.
So you want to start over?
No, I don't, because right now I like, so I guess what I want to get at eventually is what you see in the work that you, okay, let me just go back. You lived in Hawaii for how long and when?
I lived in Hawaii between 2003 and 2008.
Okay. Ooh, that was pre a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so much has changed. I mean,
what's changed?
The city in terms of development. There's so much development now that has taken place since I left. But the art scene seems to be more variegated than it was when I was here. Maybe I was just more reclusive. I can't imagine because I was out quite a lot when I was here during that time. But it seems to be quite variegated in terms of the people doing, whether it's media, working in new media, doing performative work.
You're saying the production is variegated. You're seeing different kinds of works out of different material.
Yeah, and artists who are comfortable in practices that are back up. Let's see. You have a question?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I see when I come back, often I come back, and I don't get out that often to studios, but I'm recognizing the number of artists who are comfortable in pluralistic practices, and that's not new necessarily, but when I was here, you were a painter, you were a sculptor, you were a craftsman, a printmaker, and quite often that's kind of the extent of the range of interest, but also facility and materials and approaches to making art. And I see a lot of artists who are really very open and comfortable working across media and even experimenting with, you know, whether it's performance or the media, which is, I think, very healthy. It's a really terrific sign, I think, for the art scene in Hollywood.
You can look at it from so many different angles. So help me with this one, Michael. You're seeing a lot of production in different media. What are you seeing in terms of venues or outlets or distribution? Anything? Hello? It's a bit of a vacuum on that end.
Yeah, maybe I'm not the best person to ask because I don't. When I come, I stay with my friends, family, and do family stuff. But I've noticed that there are fewer venues, commercial venues, for contemporary art, and there are now. You know, we no longer have a contemporary museum here, so there are fewer venues for contemporary art practice. It seems. Mm-hmm. I may be wrong.
What tell me your experience with the artists in your area. What are their practices like compared to here? How do they go from making things to actually being able to live?
In Atlanta? Atlanta, there are a number of venues that are really vital to the city and have been around for a long time, like the Contemporary Arts Center, which used to be a press, Nexus Press. Now it's a Contemporary Arts Center, and there are artist studios behind the center's building. So it's this wonderful hub of artistic activity in Atlanta. There's the High Museum, and I've been pretty aggressive in terms of collecting contemporary art, but also curating exhibitions, whether my own exhibitions or bringing exhibitions in of contemporary, mainly contemporary art. Sometimes art that you describe as modern, you know, mm-hmm. modern era.
How do you find artists?
In Atlanta, I listen to artists and I do studio visits.
You listen to artists?
I ask artists who they're interested in right now in our city and then seek them out or I'll go to, you know, thesis shows at the university, Georgia State University, or Kennesaw, or any of the other schools. So that's how I tend to find artists who are interesting to me and who are doing interesting things. But mainly, I listen to artists. A lot of artists teach, always, right, in the city and in Atlanta. And so when they have students they're excited about, then that's a good sign.
Okay, now let's talk about the works that you saw the last few days.
Well, a lot of the work I saw when I was here in December doing studio visits. And it was a great week. We spent a week here going to studios all over town, just in on Oahu. And none of the artists we visited I was familiar with. They were all new to me. But they weren't new to the scene here, of course, like Imolai Kalani Kalahele.
Yeah, not new to the scene.
Imolai Kalani Kalahele.
He's been here for 100 years.
Yeah, yeah.
You visited Imai. Oh.
I was really excited about what we saw, you know, from Imai Kalani's sculptures and paintings. I really responded to the sculptures. They were, I thought, incredible. The energy that he seemed to be sort of synthesizing from being out there where his studio is located in the middle of the rainforest, and using very modest material but really elevating them in a way that that showed that he respected the dignity of the material itself, whether it was wire or air roots from different plants that he harvests.
Were you very much concerned with the sort of ideological impetus of the show, the project of the exhibition as a whole?
The context zone. It was a thesis that had been established before I was invited to participate, and I thought it was interesting because it's we left it purposely very open-ended because there are so many different kinds of points of contact and zones of contact that you can think of, and so I hope that the works that we selected and also curated into the show represent these different experiences of, you know, contact in a way. You know, contact can often be confrontational, can be violent, it can be also very pleasant and can be life-affirming and can be something that helps you to cultivate yourself, your imagination, your mind. So those are two ends of the spectrum, and I think we try to look at both ends of that question of contact in the context of Hawaii, you know, and not shy away from the political, but also not we didn't want to sort of.
In a sense, when people deal with political topics, it's a way of keeping the topic at arm's length, in a way, you know.
Yeah. Right. Right. Well, it also can become, I think, just so didactic that there is a choir that one preaches to when one becomes overtly political, that it's not very interesting. It doesn't, I think, add a lot, or doesn't contribute to a conversation that a work could contribute to, you know, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It shuts down, I think, the possibility for the production of meaning in work.
Hmm.
So we purposely did not simply look for work that was just political in nature, but it was also very personal in nature as well, about relationships, about hybridity in terms of, you know, maybe being Hapa, or maybe in terms of your own cultural background that you bring with you to a place like Hawaii, or you take with you from Hawaii and somewhere else, and that kind of a hybrid experience, I think, can be very beautiful and very instructive today, when there's so many things that are caustic and ugly, and that do shut down, I think,
conversations and the possibilities that arise from conversations with people. When you sit down, you can have a conversation or an argument even, but it can be productive and it can be meaningful.
Yeah, we do shy away from that, don't we? What are some of the concerns that you saw people working with in their pieces?
I think some concerns, I wouldn't say concern so much with Andrew's work, but it rather it was a fascination. It's almost like a clinical fascination with language and the different languages that are spoken on the streets of Waikiki every day, people coming and going, and you hear this ambient sound of people speaking to each other. And you, what they did was to capture those moments, those fragments of conversations, and to basically document them, write them down. But they wrote them down as they heard them. So even if they were misheard, that was the intention, you know. And so it was really an interesting idea to think about how we construct, or rather how we comport and ourselves and how we behave in the context of a place like Waikiki, and that behavior is informed by these fragments of language that we don't necessarily understand. And that's an interesting idea that sort of encapsulates a lot of what I think this show is about, the context zone, about the whether it's lost in translation or a new translation, that there's something that's new that can arise from this, from contact with someone or something new, or possibly even dangerous, you know.
Somehow, just seeing something in a new way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Seeing something in a new way, thinking about something in a new way. So. So in that project specifically, I think that the artists were really very careful about not coming to the project with an opinion already formed about what they wanted to quote say unquote, you know, or what they were looking for. They weren't cherry picking, you know, these moments of. That they were documenting, but rather they were simply documenting science in an almost scientific way.
Yeah, social science experiment social going science on experiment. Here.
Yeah, with the one control being there's no editing, there's no, you know, there's no editorial involved. Simply collecting this information and seeing what happens when you finally put it back together again.
That is neat.
Yeah.
Artists can pose some pretty interesting questions, that's why, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. What about materials? What were materials like that you saw in this batch?
Imai Kalani uses materials that he harvests out at his studio, whether they're arrowroots from plants or other organic materials, but also wire and plastic and. That he finds and repurposes and weaves into these beautiful figurative sculptures.
Is the art world over precious materials? I mean, really, give us some guidance on this.
No, it's not. The art world loves precious materials. Shiny, glossy.
Long-lasting.
Long-lasting, right.
Archivally correct.
Archivally something that will withstand the years and environments it lives in, so that will never change. But artists, I think, are always or typically experimental in nature in the kinds of materials that they wish to use, because materials respond differently to each other, different kinds of materials, and The artists that we met here during the December studio visits were all fairly experimental and open-ended in their curiosity about different kinds of materials. Chris, he makes the mushroom painting.
Ritson.
Chris Ritson.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Chris Ritson, who grows mushrooms and uses mushrooms as the material for his artwork, is a great, great example of that. I mean, his studio, have you been to his studio? Oh my God, it's like another science lab. You know, you think you go into this incredible research station, you know, up in Tantalus. And it's really a very interesting for me to have learned about his the discipline with which he goes about his practice as an artist, but also the depth and seriousness of his research, which is extending into the scientific, where there are people who are working with him to document different species of mushrooms and plants.
We're seeing a lot more of this sort of interlap or overlap of science and art. Hmm?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. There's also artists like Kalani Larguso. Do you know Kalani?
I'm trying to remember what that work looks like.
As a painter. Kalani lives on Kauai.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay.
He makes abstract paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it lines? Am I seeing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Pictures I can show you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, So I think Kalani's paintings are I think, fantastic. And so here's an artist who is really working with traditional materials, oil paint on canvas, and has a studio practice, unlike some artists who I suppose you could say there's post-studio practice today and there's studio practice, which is more conventional. You know, you make paintings in the studio and you do your thing. So I really admire Kalani for pursuing that painterly practice in such a serious way, that is introspective but doesn't get lost in his introspection. His introspection rather is a form of research for his work.
Oh, that's so well put.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what is post-studio practice like?
Post-studio practice means you can do it from Hawaii, you can do it from Costa Rica, you can essentially... whether it's taking advantage of different means of production, you know, farming out the production of your work to fabricators around the world, or designing a concept, thinking of a set of instructions or systems that then can be performed and reperformed by other people elsewhere. Work then can be distributed through the internet, through the media, and
digital format.
Digital format, right? Streaming media, media that's guerrilla style media that, you know, there's no established platform. It just kind of appears and is transient. So that's becoming it has been an important aspect of contemporary art practice for quite a while, but it starts to become, I think, more. You start to see more of it. It becomes more prevalent in cities like Chicago, where I'm from, or Honolulu, outside of
where
LA
is it
or
prevalent?
New York.
I mean, where do I see that?
I think Brooklyn and New York, and
the people who make it live there. You're saying?
Yeah, a lot of artists who live in New York, because space is a problem too, uh-huh. Right? Having a big studio in
a
place like
New York.
They have a computer, right, and they can make art, whether it's in their apartment or at a coffee shop. I was recently at an exhibition outside of Taipei, the Asian Art Biennial, it's called, and there was a wonderful post-internet artist. It's a form of, it's a new category, I suppose, post-internet artist from Manila. The idea of post-internet artist, very simply put, I guess, is to say that the internet is just another material, like oil paint or clay or what have you, that's used as another material, and its unique character and functionality is not
physical at all.
It's not relevant really to the to the work, to the practice. It's just another kind of material that the artist is using.
So what is important to the work?
Often it's sculptural or installation. The work is a sculptural installation. Often it's environmental. So it's not something that has to, that should be hung in a wall necessarily. Maybe it should be hung in a wall, or maybe it can sit on a table or a pedestal or sit in the middle of the floor or occupy space in other ways.
But how does this
occupy, I mean, like virtual space?
It's so fascinating and really thrilling. But it sounds like a kind of art that needs an intermediary. I mean, somebody that can explain it to you, introduce you to it, and then, you know.
I think it's experiential. In that sense. So I think as an audience, when you experience that work, you have to be open-minded. And most contemporary art audiences are pretty open-minded. So it's really about the experience of it. And that's what one of the great aspects or triumphs of this kind of art making is, that it's not fetishizing technology, rather
or objects.
Or objects, right. It's simply using available materials that are out in the world, that are abundant, and recombining them in ways that make us see the world and think about the world in a new way.
So I might, as an artist, generate a set of instructions maybe for how to take cans and tires someplace and arrange them in a certain way to create a certain experience.
Yeah, that kind of, or doing that as a kind of open source experiment where you as the artist are then making these available to artists around the world to make, you know, sculptures, your sculptures all over the place.
What's this do to galleries and museums?
Well, galleries. There's always the gallery scene is always evolving, right? So now there's a lot of people who are upset about the big galleries. There's a handful of really very big international galleries, and the smaller or mid-sized galleries are having a tough time, especially in like centers like New York or maybe LA, not so much as LA maybe, but they're having a harder time having a go at it because the cost of maintaining a space. Artists, when they achieve a measure of success, are then sort of headhunted by bigger galleries with more resources. And who can blame them? Because, you know, when you have more resources available to do publications, to do shows in multiple cities.
Ooh, yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So so it's having, I think, what we're talking about in terms of the practice, the sort of post-internet or post-studio practice, that will have an impact on galleries. But I think galleries will adjust to it, and they are adjusting to it. It just means that the traditional, the way we think about galleries traditionally will change. And
are they shutting down and going to art fairs and just keeping their stables?
Well, art fairs is probably the more is a greater influence on how galleries operate and whether or not they can survive. The art fairs are essential to survival to most galleries. Because you have access to all these markets, they're also very expensive. So for a lot of galleries that participate, the going to an art fair can be merely a marketing tool, you know, where they either lose money or they break even and are happy with having been invited into a prestigious art fair and meeting a number of, you know, big collectors, influential and important writers, curators, whomever, museum groups that come by, and you know, you can hold court in your space at an art fair. But art fairs are a big influence today on the bricks and mortar sort of gallery scene, the mom and pop gallery scene. in cities like ours, here in Honolulu or Chicago or Atlanta even. So
So we're supposed to have a big art fair here.
Right. That was supposed to happen last year, right?
And the year before.
And it didn't. And that's happening at the convention center.
You know, I hope they do well. I don't know. But I don't know how an art... How does an art scene develop? I don't know how art is supposed to be kept being made these days.
Right. Yeah, well, no, that's a good question, because how do you make art when there is the market is so, well, fragmented but small, and in the case of Hawaii, very unique. It's self-contained.
Yeah,
you know?
Unfortunately.
And a lot of the big collectors probably still go to the mainland or to Europe or to Asia and buy work there.
Yep.
And are not interested in what's happening locally. So we were talking about earlier with these spaces that come and go, that as part of an ecosystem that has existed for so long, for decades and decades, and will always continue to be. But I think that's one vital aspect of an art scene, that there are these spaces that open up that are, whether they're pop-up galleries, whether it's a one-nighter like Mr. Koga, John Koga used to do all the time, or spaces that are around for a couple of years and then move on, either close or move on and become something else. That is the sign that there is health in an art scene, and it's driven primarily by the artists in the city. And for me, that's really to create an art scene, artists have to do it. Collectors are not going to do it because collectors are more or less self-interested. So artists have to drive it, and that's easy to say, especially when you've got one or two or more jobs you're trying to do to make ends meet, and then open a space and make art for it,
and yet it's been done.
It's
over
been done.
The years, it's been done. SPF Gallery was there for a while. We had Workspace in Kaimuki.
I love
there
Workspace.
There was nothing else before.
That was Cade Rosters?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
People somehow have kept it going here.
Right, right. Yeah, and the same in Atlanta. So we had a number of gallery closings in Atlanta over the last several years, and there's a lot of hand-wringing and people bemoaning the end of the gallery scene of art in Atlanta. It's like, this is going to happen all the time. These places, whether they're established galleries or small experimental spaces, are going to come and go. That's just the life of the art scene here. But
ride it.
Ride it, yeah. And when the next iteration of that pops up somewhere or emerges, then support it. At least support it with your presence and your curiosity. And not to say... that art scenes are made from boosters, like boosterism. It's important to be supportive, but also it's important to be critical, and that's also what artists, I think, can lend to an art scene, to both support the nascent character of contemporary art venues that are either commercial or not for profit, but artists, that is, can then provide the sort of critical edge that make them vital to the cultural life of the city, and not merely a place for that's transactional, you know?
Oh, God. Yes, that's so true. I'm so glad you said that. It'd be so easy to have galleries come up with all kinds of, watercolor landscapes and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. Right, where there's a purpose. I mean, for artists, there's a purpose.
That's
and
why.
For galleries, there should be a purpose too. I mean, that purpose should be connected with, or should be in alignment with that of the artists they serve, and the audience then benefits from that. Ideally, I know.
I can see that starting to happen, and it's because of contact. They started this little hooey started out as kind of like a just a hui. And then they started to kind of exert their curatorial perspective by doing these little pop-up things, and contact emerged and then held on. And this is the fifth year of it.
Yeah.
So that now it's really turning into content.
Yeah, yeah. I saw last year's contact. I thought it was fantastic. And I've seen a couple of iterations of it. I don't know if Drew Broderick's, when he had his space, if that was part of it. I think it was just before. But what Drew was doing in his space, I thought was really exciting in Kaka'ako. And that was after I had left, so I was a little bit chagrined, a little jealous that I wasn't part of it, because it was really cool to see happening. You know?
I know, people who are just leveraging what they know, spaces. We need space, we need space, we need time to work, just how to make it.
And we don't need a fancy space, not a fancy space with, you know, parking and, moldings around the ceilings and, you know, special track lights. It can be a garage with a roll-up door, concrete floor, and, you know, DIY. That's exciting.
It is. The first place I saw Keith Tallett. And
yeah.
Show
was so good.
Right?
That was such a great show. Oh, my God. I still want, like, three of those paintings.
I know.
And the big installation upstairs, remember, with the jugs?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
This is us, you know. We remember these high moments in Honolulu art history. So glad you're back here for this one, Michael.
Thank you so much. It's always so good to see you.